Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At Airbus, we're at the forefront of new technology. We're redefining the aerospace industry by using disruptive technologies and new energies to reduce our environmental impact.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're bringing the world together, collaborating, and acting on climate change. At Airbus, we're pioneering sustainable aerospace for a safe and united world. Learn more at airbus.com.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 7th of February. On the eve of elections, at least 27 people are killed in two bomb attacks in Pakistan. Russian missiles and drones bring new devastation to Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities. And the fentanyl crisis gripping Mexico's border cities. Also in the podcast...
Even if you do argue that Putin should be given a platform, Tucker Carlson's not the man to do it. He's a propagandist, not a serious journalist.
The sacked Fox News host interviews the Russian president in Moscow. A day before bitterly fought elections take place in Pakistan, two bomb attacks have killed at least 27 people in Balochistan province. The chaotic aftermath of one of the bombings as dazed survivors wander around burning bits of wreckage. The explosions targeted the offices of election candidates. Security had been tightened ahead of the poll, with 500,000 personnel being deployed. Tensions are high after the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was jailed. I got the latest from our correspondent in Pakistan, Saha Baloch.
Today, as we, all of us were like looking at the news today, Qila Saifullah, which is a district in Balochistan province, it was attacked. A party office of Jamiat Ulema-Islam Fazal, which is JUIF Fazal over here, a religious political party in Balochistan, their office, election office, was attacked. And before that, in Peshin, which is another area, an independent candidate's election office was also attacked. So these two came one after the other. And as a result, there were multiple people who reportedly got killed as a result of it. And there were others who also got injured. So police right now is trying to investigate what exactly happened. And this, of course, came a day before the elections, as people are literally gearing up for the election day.
Yeah. And how tight has security been ahead of those elections, given the controversy over the fact that Imran Khan, former prime minister, is not able to stand?
Security is, of course, on high alert. There were other provinces as well. For instance, Sindh province had also asked the army to stand in the election area as well, because they were expecting something to go wrong. Similarly, in other areas as well, for instance, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, which is usually a sensitive area with regards to elections, there was also expected that security will be on high alert. But interestingly and unfortunately, for past 1 month, Balochistan has been facing and bearing the brunt of all of these attacks, whether it was attacks by the insurgents in the area or whether it was by other militant organizations. But these attacks have been happening in Balochistan one after the other for a month now.
Pakistan is no stranger to political violence. How has this run up to the election felt to you?
Well, last year when this was being discussed in the Supreme Court as well, there were political parties who did show their reservations about holding elections at that point of time, because they were fearing that there would be attacks on the elections as well. But at the same time, there were others who were like, you know, these elections have to be held only because, you know, the establishment in the country or the military establishment now wants to show to the rest of the world that there is democracy in Pakistan and they want to hold these elections. And as far as you spoke about Imran Khan, so yes, he's in prison right now, but he's trying to run his digital campaign at the moment, which is also facing a lot of disruptions.
Saha Baloch in Pakistan. At least 5 people have died in the latest Russian bombardment on Ukraine. 4 were killed in the capital Kyiv, where 2 apartment buildings were hit. These residents managed to escape.
Around 4:30, we started getting ready and came here to the metro because we had to take shelter. We know what it is and how it's going to be. It's not the first time, not the second time, or the 10th either. It's been happening for 2 years in our country.
I approached the emergency services. I said there are 3 people on the 12th floor. 2 of them are bedridden. They're stuck inside and can't leave. That's what I saw.
Another person was killed in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Sarah Rainsford is at the scene of the attack on Kyiv.
I'm standing in front of a giant block of flats here, a really big building which stretches for a whole block, and there is an awful lot of destruction. Many flats here are totally ruined. What happened here was the Russian missile was flying overhead. It was intercepted by air defences, Ukrainian air defence, and then the fragments landed on this building. And people I've been speaking to here have described a massive explosion, a big bang, and then the whole building shaking. They say that the windows were blown out and their doors, in many cases, were blown out. And then there has been a fire, and it was a fire that lasted for many hours after the missile attack. Some people have lost absolutely everything. There are lots and lots of people milling around. Hundreds and thousands, in fact, I think, of residents of this building have been evacuated from the building. Lots of people looking just bewildered and lost and distraught. People hugging each other, plenty of people in tears, and people wandering around with small children, with dogs, with little bags of possessions, anything they could bring out with them. But as I say, many have lost everything, and people are still pretty shocked, because this is Kyiv, this is the capital, and it really is a reminder of the fact that the danger, the risk is very real right across this country every time Russia launches missiles in this direction.
Sarah Rainsford in Ukraine. The synthetic opioid fentanyl is 50 times stronger than heroin, and was responsible for tens of thousands of overdose deaths in the United States last year. Relatively easy to produce, it's smuggled in large quantities across the Mexico-US border. But it's also a problem in Mexico itself. Last week, the Mexican president said he was introducing a new law to make it illegal to take fentanyl. But it may be too late for border cities like Tijuana, as our correspondent in Mexico, Will Grant, reports.
Tijuana's fire service hasn't had a quiet night in months. Around 1 in the morning on a freezing winter night, they called out to La Perla, a local bar. But there's no blaze to put out. Rather, they're tackling another crisis spreading through the city like wildfire, fentanyl. At the bar, 2 men are unconscious, apparently clinging to life by a thread. The paramedics administer Narcan, the most effective drug to reverse a fentanyl overdose. The men may not have even realised they were taking fentanyl. As it's so cheap and so powerful, the Mexican cartels have started to cut it into recreational drugs like cocaine.
Aquí nosotros no producimos fentanilo.
Recently, though, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, denied the problem even exists.
Y nosotros no tenemos consumo de fentanilo.
We don't produce fentanyl here. We don't consume fentanyl here, he said, urging the U.S. to take care of the problem on its side of the border. The state forensic service disagrees. In a study on all of the bodies which enter Tijuana's morgue, last July they found a staggering 1 in 3 contained fentanyl. Preven Casa is a harm reduction centre in Tijuana which runs a needle exchange and other services for addicts.
So this is the vial, this is what it came in, the heroin or the drugs came in?
That's it. Okay.
In front of me, its director, Lily Pacheco, selected 2 used needles and 2 used drug vials at random. All 4 pieces of drug paraphernalia tested positive for fentanyl. The border is flooded with it, she says.
Esa es la falta del reconocimiento de una realidad.
It's a lack of recognition of this reality. Of course fentanyl exists. I know the president said it doesn't, but we have the evidence right here. All those who've died from fentanyl overdoses are part of that evidence too. Ignoring the problem won't solve it. People will keep dying from this.
The roughest part of Tijuana is around the city's canal, where homeless people, including many recently deported migrants, make shelter under bridges and in storm drains. The mental health and drug addiction problems here are rife. Irma, a recovering heroin addict who grew up in the US but lives in a tent on Tijuana's streets, says fentanyl has made a bad situation worse.
It's mixed on crystal, it's mixed on everything, even on the weed. You put a little dust on it and they kill them because they haven't used that before.
Overdoses, I imagine you see them all the time.
Every day. Every day. I try to save their lives when I can, but sometimes they call me when it's too late.
Don't move, don't move. What do you mean? Hablas español?
Back at La Perla Bar, it took three doses of Narcan, but the paramedics managed to bring one of the two men back from the brink. His friend, however, wasn't so fortunate. He died amid the beer bottles and empty glasses on the barroom floor. His family, including his mother, has arrived and been told the news. At 27, he's another victim of this most potent of narcotics, the latest young person to overdose on fentanyl without even knowing he was taking it.
Will Grant reporting from Mexico. In 2022, a young American computer programmer called Jack Sweeney rose to fame tracking the flight paths of the private jets belonging to billionaires, posting the routes and estimated carbon emissions of each journey. It led to a row with Tesla and ex-boss Elon Musk. Now, Mr. Sweeney is focusing on Taylor Swift's plane, and she is not happy. A recent post shows a journey of just 45 kilometres across the city of St. Louis that took 13 minutes and produced 0.8 tonnes of carbon dioxide. Lawyers representing the pop star have sent two cease and desist letters citing security concerns. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy told me how Jack Sweeney tracks private jets.
He uses publicly available information, mostly from the likes of the Federal Aviation Administration in the US, whereby if you have the tracker number for a plane, you can put it in to the database and it'll tell you details about exactly how to get the transponder number. And then you would put that into something like Flight Radar, which monitors the taking off and flights and landings of planes around the world. And that's how he does it. And lots of other places do this as well. He is by far the most famous and most successful one of these celebrity jet tracking services. But he also has to use some information that isn't as easily attainable. So, for example, there are some people, including Taylor Swift, who have managed to get the flight number and the transponder details taken off the publicly available database. But using a bit of sleuthing and sort of hobbyist aviation experts, they can pretty quickly work out whose jets are whose. For example, looking at Taylor Swift's tour details, where she will be in certain cities around the world at certain points, and they can kind of put the two and two together, and that's how they get the information to track the jets.
So it doesn't sound like he's doing anything illegal. What is Taylor Swift's problem?
Well, they're saying it's a security risk. They're saying that this is allowing people that want to get close to Taylor Swift to know exactly where she is at any one time. He says that he's posting the details and the data later, so like a day after the event. So it's not saying exactly where she is at any one time. And of course, it only tells you where she's landing and taking off, and it doesn't tell you where she will go after that. But Taylor Swift is, of course, one of the most famous people in the world, one of the most sought after by her fans. And there have been cases of some sinister behavior. So there was someone arrested and is facing charges for stalking, for example, in the last few months after they were found outside her house.
Yeah, and I guess they could use this kind of information to find out where she is. But what kind of laws might deal with this?
Well, I don't think there is anything that deals with this currently because, of course, he's been doing this for a couple of years. Most famously before this, it was Elon Musk. He had a big row with Musk on the platform formerly known as Twitter on X. And nothing was done in terms of, you know, stopping him. It seems to me that the way that he is being policed right now is by social networks. So, for example, X took his account down, so he wasn't able to post on there anymore about where Elon Musk's jet is. But then I'm looking at it now on Instagram, Elon Musk jet, and that's got 50,000 followers. So there are some social networks that do allow these profiles to stay up.
Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Most people that come here don't have any, haven't had the food before, but people could see bits that remind them of themselves.
The first black woman in the UK to secure a Michelin star on how everyone can identify with West African cooking.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
At Airbus, we bring the world together. Our aircraft connects communities, facilitating cross-cultural communication. Our satellite technology enables communication across the world and allows us to explore space, expanding human knowledge to create a better future on Earth. At Airbus, we're pioneering sustainable aerospace for a safe and united world. Learn more at airbus.com.
On the latest stop of his Middle East tour, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has met the Israeli president. He said he was hoping that Hamas and Israel would agree a deal to free the hostages in Gaza in return for a pause in the fighting, but he said there was still a lot of work to be done. Earlier, the Qatari mediator said Hamas had responded positively to US-Israeli proposals for a deal. The Palestinian group has countered with a three-stage ceasefire plan. And for more details, we heard from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Nick Beek.
It's worth looking at what the Reuters news agency have been reporting in the last couple of hours, because they say they've seen a copy, or certainly a draft, of what are really Hamas's counter-proposals. So last night we had Hamas, a senior figure, telling the BBC that they'd put forward, in his words, a positive vision of how a peace framework could basically be brought into effect. And what Reuters is saying is that within the Hamas plans, there would be three phases, and each one would be 45 days long. So if this were to come into being, it's a big if, there would be quite a sustained lull in the fighting, which it would hope would lead to a permanent ceasefire. And what Hamas is saying is that in this first 45 days, hostages that were taken on October the 7th would be released, specifically the women and children. Then there would be another 45-day period in which other hostages were released. And then finally, the remains of hostages who have died would be released in the third phase of 45 days. For this to happen, Hamas are talking about the release of 1,500 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. So this is the first time we've got a specific figure. And within that, the talk is of 500 prisoners who have been given life sentences by Israel. So clearly, there is a lot in this. The caveat is that this is a draft, it's being reported. But I think that the fundamental position, which is difficult at the moment, is that Hamas is saying that for this to happen, Israeli troops have to be withdrawn completely from Gaza, and Israel is saying that simply isn't going to happen.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. According to a preliminary report from US investigators, a door panel that flew off from a Boeing 737 MAX jet in mid-air appeared to be missing four bolts. The incident on an Alaskan Airlines flight led to the grounding of all MAX jets. Replying to the report, Boeing said it was accountable and is implementing a comprehensive plan to strengthen quality and confidence. Our international business correspondent Theo Leggett spoke to Nigel Adderley.
Well, this was an aircraft that was taking off from Portland International Airport in Oregon in early January. And shortly after takeoff, a panel which was used to cover up an unused emergency exit door blew out of the aircraft. Suddenly, there was a large hole in the aircraft. All the air was rushing out. Nobody was seriously injured, but clearly people within the aircraft were very badly shocked. And the issue here is that if that same accident had happened at a higher altitude, when people were not strapped into their seats and when the pressure differential between outside the aircraft and inside was that much greater, it could have been an absolute tragedy.
So what does the report say?
Well, this is the preliminary report from the US National Transportation Safety Board. It says that this plug in the fuselage, which would normally be bolted securely in place, does not appear to have had 4 essential retaining bolts fitted. Now, this door plug was installed by Boeing's contractor Spirit AeroSystems in sections of fuselage that were then shipped to Boeing for assembly in its plant in Washington State. But at some point, that door plug was removed. It had a manufacturing defect that had to be rectified. And when it was put back, photographic evidence suggests that those bolts were not installed again. And this is backed up by the damage to the door and its surroundings. And questions are already being asked about Boeing's manufacturing processes. This will make the spotlight that's shining on the company even harsher.
And of course, for Boeing, it is immensely embarrassing and could have reputational damage as well. But fundamentally, this is something that we often take for granted when we go on a plane, that this sort of thing will be taken care of.
That's absolutely correct. But this is where concerns over the 737 MAX, this particular type of aircraft, come in. Because this aircraft, which is a relatively new version of a very old aircraft, already has a checkered safety record. 5 years ago, two 737 MAX crashed because they'd had flight control software installed that was badly designed and which countermanded the actions of the pilots. It malfunctioned and it drove those aircraft into the ground. So there have been questions ever since about the way in which this aircraft was certified and whether it was fit for purpose. Now, Boeing has always insisted that it's cleaned up its act, that its main focus is on safety, and that there is nothing wrong with the 737 MAX now. But what this incident illustrates or reinforces is concerns that conditions in Boeing's factories simply aren't good enough, that it's not putting enough effort into quality control, and that its main supplier, Spirit AeroSystems, is also making mistakes. And there have been other problems on the production line. It'll focus attention not only on Boeing, but also on the US regulator, the Federal Aviation Administration, which is supposed to oversee Boeing and make sure that every aircraft leaving its factories is as safe as it can possibly be.
Our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. The sacked Fox News host Tucker Carlson has popped up in Moscow, where he's become the first Western journalist to interview Vladimir Putin since the war in Ukraine began. The right-wing media personality has drawn accusations he's acting as a propaganda tool for the Russian president, who he has frequently defended. Russian media say Carlson, quote, speaks the truth. In a video post, Tucker Carlson defended the interview.
Here's why we're doing it. First, because it's our job. We're in journalism. Our duty is to inform people. 2 years into a war that's reshaping the entire world, most Americans are not informed. They have no real idea what's happening in this region, here in Russia or 600 miles away in Ukraine. But they should know. They're paying for much of it in ways they might not fully yet perceive.
Christopher Steele is a former British intelligence officer and an expert on Russia. He spoke to Justin Webb about what impact the controversial interview might have.
I think it will add fuel to what is effectively a push in America at the moment on the hard right, particularly in Congress, to discredit Ukraine and the war and to undermine American support for that, which is critical at the present time, particularly in terms of arms supplies.
Do you think that there is some merit in Americans getting to see Vladimir Putin defending the war, even if he is allowed to say things about it that are not true or tendentious?
I personally don't. I mean, I think you've got to bear in mind that Putin is an indicted war criminal, and also that Russia has been arresting and imprisoning, in fact, Western journalists of late who have been trying to report on the war from Russia. Alsu Kumarsheva of Radio Free Europe and Evan Gershkovich, better known of Wall Street Journal, are both in prison at the moment in Russia. But I think even if you do argue that Putin should be given a platform, Tucker Carlson's not the man to do it. He's a propagandist, not a serious journalist. And when you look at serious people like your own Steve Rosenberg, for example, when he turned up at Putin's annual media event in December and tried to ask questions, he was refused. And so I don't think this is a serious exercise. It's an exercise of propaganda and nothing more.
Is there a risk as well that Putin will talk darkly about the consequences for the West? And I'm thinking of further war, possibly even nuclear war, which is something they have talked about in the past, if the West writ large doesn't stand down.
I think the Chinese have probably put that back in the box and told Putin to stop talking about nuclear threats and so on. But of course, what comes out from Putin will be an attempt to divide the West, to spread divisions, particularly in the United States in the run-up to the elections this year, which are pretty existential, I would argue, for Putin and his campaign in Ukraine. And the only way I think Putin will ever win the war in Ukraine is by nullifying America's support for Ukraine, which is his primary objective, I would say, at the moment.
Former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele. When it comes to football, conventional wisdom has it that the manager is all important. Where would Manchester United have been without Alex Ferguson, or Arsenal without Arsene Wenger? In the modern era, it's all about Pep and Jürgen. But how much impact does the manager really have? Well, the hosts of the Africa Cup of Nations, Ivory Coast, sacked their boss after a dismal start to the tournament. And yet, they are now in the semi-final. And ahead of that match, here are the thoughts of football writer Simon Cooper.
There's a strange obsession in football with managers. The manager gets too much credit when they win, and too much blame when their team lose. In fact, that's why managers are sacked so often, because they're seen as having almost magical powers to achieve victory or defeat. But I've never believed it. I think managers just don't matter very much. For a case study, look at the Ivory Coast, host nation of the current African Nations Cup. The Ivorian national team, nicknamed the Elephants, started the tournament disastrously. When they lost 4-0 to Little Equatorial Guinea, they risked being knocked out of their own tournament. Somehow the Elephants survived, but their French manager, Jean-Louis Gasset, did not. He was sacked. Gasset's replacement, assistant coach Emerson Faye, had never managed a senior team of any kind. Yet under Faye, the Elephants have revived, with drama and lots of luck. They beat African champions Senegal, then Mali, and tonight they face the Democratic Republic of Congo in the semi-final. Does this mean Faye is a genius? Did he inspire his men to victory? I doubt it. By far the best predictor of a club team's strength are the wages it pays its players. Typically, the team with the highest salaries hires the best players and finishes top of the league, while the team with the lowest salaries and worst players finishes bottom. True, there are brief exceptions, like not very rich Leicester City winning the Premier League in 2016, but measured over a 10-year period, players' salaries explain about 90% of team performance. The message: good players win football matches. Managers matter much less. In fact, it's estimated that only about 10% of them consistently improved their teams. Managers like Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, and Alex Ferguson. But most managers add so little value. If Ivory Coast win the African Nations Cup, their manager, Emerson Faye, will be celebrated as the hero. He shouldn't be. In football, almost always, players win matches.
Football writer Simon Cooper. And finally, fermented rice cake, mushroom puree and a side of plantain. Just some of the dishes that have helped Adejoke Bakare become the first black woman in the UK to be awarded a Michelin star. She is the founder and head chef at Chicharu, which specialises in West African cooking. She spoke to Sarah Montague.
I'm still in a daze, I have to say. I think people could connect to the fact that we're sharing our heritage and people could see themselves on the table. Most people that come here haven't had the food before, but people could see bits that remind them of themselves. So our XO sauce, which is, it's called Shito, but I've had somebody come here and they go, oh, it's like XO sauce. I know XO sauce. So it's things like that. Because I think before, West African food has been seen as this fairly scary, inaccessible thing. But when people come, they see that part of it, tell their friends, and for us mostly it has been word of mouth.
So do you think it's been overlooked? I mean, it seems astonishing to me that you're only the second black woman globally, but also that West African food hasn't had a sort of featured in the list of Michelin stars.
Well, with this now, thank God, they'll start looking into the continent itself. There are loads of young cooks doing fantastic things. I think with more people going on holidays, eating food, then coming back and going, oh, this is not something that I've not had before.
I was thinking, you think about there are restaurants, whether it's, I don't know, the sort of brands that have made Japanese food very popular and widely known. Similarly for Lebanese food and around the Mediterranean. Do we need some sort of brand across the country that is going to introduce everyone to West African food?
I think we are doing that now, aren't we? But as much as we want people to have it, for me, it is also about the history, so that it's not diluted so much that it's low loses itself.
I mean, obviously, it's a huge accolade. It's a compliment. Is it also change, or does it feel a little bit like a weight? Because now people are going to come with certain expectations.
Oh, yes. Oh, there is that. There is this thing where I say, yes, it's a change. I spoke to a chef friend of mine yesterday, and he was close to tears. He said, oh, my God, this has restored my faith in Michelin, because it means it's all about the food now.
Adejoke Bakare. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons and produced by Rebecca Wood. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
At Airbus, we're at the forefront of new technology. We're redefining the aerospace industry by using disruptive technologies and new energies to reduce our environmental impact.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're bringing the world together, collaborating, and acting on climate change. At Airbus, we're pioneering sustainable aerospace for a safe and united world. Learn more at airbus.com.